Hello, I'm pleased to be joined on the podcast today by Zenor's James Salter. James, a longtime fund manager at Polar Capital, set up Zenor with David Mitchinson 3 years ago. That partnership of one value and one more growth-focused investor has turned out to be a case of excellent timing. With interest in Japanese equities reviving since, the fund has started strongly and grown to around £360 million of assets today. The team have also just launched an income strategy. James, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Before we dive into your career and how you came to set up Zenor, as I said, Japanese equities are seeing a bit of a renaissance this year, at least in terms of interest amongst UK investors. Yeah. I suppose, you know, why is this time different from the many false dawns we've had before?
I think one of the biggest differences, Jeremy, has been that the foreign investor has not driven the recent market performance. So we've actually had a stealth bull market since really about 2012, when the market hit the lows of 8 to 10,000 on the Nikkei. And the foreigner was certainly involved in the early days, the first 3 or 4 years. He put in $300 billion, but he proceeded then between about 15 and 2018, 19 to take out all of that money. But actually, the market's ascent has been driven very surreptitiously by domestic investors, and by that I mean the corporates themselves. So classic bull market indicators, you know, from people like Ben Graham and Warren Buffett, that, you know, buying, if you find companies buying their own shares, that's a really, really good sign. So that's one difference. The other
So there hasn't, it hasn't just been driven by a flood of foreign capital, basically.
It hasn't. But the other main difference is that the corporate governance code and the stewardship code, which were introduced under Mr. Abe in 2013, have continued to make ground in terms of diffusion of the gospel, so to speak, to individual companies to do the right things to look after shareholders. And that has then really had a further exocet put underneath it from the Tokyo Stock Exchange, who, you know, have been keen to find or highlight that 50% of companies trade below book. They need to raise productivity in Japan. They need to take that price to book over the next 3 to 5 years to above one. They need to look at their cost of capital, weighted average cost of capital versus their return on invested capital. And I think that combination with a very, very potent activist market in Japan. We've seen the number of activist events in Japan at all-time highs at the moment.
Do you think that's been the key change more recently?
I think that's been one of the key changes. And it hasn't just been activists, private equity activists, hedge fund activists. It's been very much driven also by domestic activists, also foreign soft activists and engagers such as ourselves, and there's a big difference, we can talk about that later, between an activist and an engagement house.
Okay, thank you. Maybe before we go into all that, maybe we'll step back a bit and ask, how on earth did you get involved in Japanese equities in the first place?
I was studying for a postgrad at School of Oriental and African Studies in Japan Area Studies in 1988, and Japan was flavor of the day, and I think I wrote my dissertation on the Japanese economic miracle, which is one of the great reverse indicators, because it promptly began to collapse over the course of the 90s with a debt deflation bubble. Anyway, I applied for some fund management jobs, and I got a couple of offers, one from Mercury Asset Management, which is now BlackRock, and the other from Foreign and Colonial, and I went for the Foreign and Colonial option.
Yeah. And then I think you joined Martin Currie, which has now seen some industry consolidation itself.
Exactly.
And in a way, that's where your connection with your partner, David, begins, right?
Maybe obliquely. It sort of begins there. Obviously, David is a generation younger than I am.
Yeah.
His father used to broke to us. So David's father was a well-known economist, had his own economic think tank, and then went into academia. And I'd kind of known, well, David in those days in 92 would have been, I'm guessing, you know, still in short trousers probably. I bumped into him in the early days of Polar, and we nearly gave him a job at Polar, to be honest.
Yeah.
For one or two reasons, things just didn't work out at the time.
Mm. Okay, well, so on Polar, you know, after Martin Currie, you worked at Schroders, and then you joined Polar Capital basically on day one, right?
I think it was about week six.
Okay, week six.
Yeah, something like that.
Okay, can you talk about that a bit, what that was like in the early days?
Yeah, it was a tremendous opportunity for me. It was set up by two former Henderson Tech managers, Brian Usher-Russell and Tim Woolley, and John Mansell as the COO, backed by Caledonia. They very much took a punt on me in the early days because I don't think the intention was to expand the fund management group outside technology.
Okay.
They were incredibly welcoming. They really, you know, I owe them everything for the development of my sort of more entrepreneurial career post 2001. And it was a great place to work, Polar. It's a fantastic organization.
Yeah. And was there an element of, you know, wanting to do your own thing a bit? You know,
giving I suppose you're at Polar, you're very much doing your own thing if you're an affiliate or a satellite fund management outfit there, because they give you an economic interest. So it's effectively a pretty entrepreneurial culture. So setting up Zenor wasn't particularly difficult for me, and it wasn't a kind of Damascene conversion to being entrepreneurial. I think, you know, all of us who were involved in Polar in the early days took a considerable risk, and it worked out with a bit of luck and some very good performance from, you know, some of the core managers.
Yeah. Okay. And your fund at Polar, you know, was a strong performer for a long time after setting up, but then went through a weaker period in the middle of the last decade. I mean, I suppose, how did you respond to that at the time, and how have you reflected on it since?
I mean, obviously a lot of reflection. I mean, I have to say, from Polar's point of view, they did absolutely everything right. From my own point of view, in retrospect, there were some mistakes I made. I think the stock selection between about 2014 and 2018 was nowhere near as good as it had been between 2001 and 2013. The second point, Jeremy, was that value was very much out of favour, and we were very much a value house. But I think it's fair to say that for the first time in my career in 35 years, I dropped the ball for 3 years. And, you know, I've been very open about that. I've stuck my hand up and I've said, you know, these are the mistakes I've made. And one of the crucial mistakes I think I made was, despite it being a growth market, I didn't run my winners for long enough. I identified a lot of really interesting value and GARP situations, but those GARP situations were sold far too early. And obviously during quantitative easing, they went to much higher multiples, but certainly we or I could have stayed around in those investments for a lot longer. That was one of the first mistakes. And then the second, you know, second issue is, you know, down to the value aspect. And it was such a growth market in those days that that knowledge base that I have of having visited 8,000 to 10,000 companies in my career, that intellectual property value was worth effectively zero, because people were focused on 30 to 50 names globally, which Japan, you know, had a very similar situation. And that knowledge base on a lot of uncovered companies was just not relevant.
Yeah.
Post the end of QQE and the beginning of inflation 2 years ago, that has become increasingly relevant.
Okay. That's an interesting point about running your winners, because that's kind of, you know, the concept's not quite anathema for a value manager, but there's a lot of focus on, you know, selling stocks once they get to your perceived fair value, isn't it?
Yeah. I think that's what David has brought to the party. I mean, I was always quite traditional and focused on sort of EV, EBITDAs, PE ratios, price to book. And I think David has brought a more judicial approach to some of these GARP stocks, looking at free cash flow, yield to enterprise value, looking at some DCF models, looking at EBITDA, exit multiples, that kind of thing. And I think my job with David has been to say, look, I'm happy to evolve the process, but at the same time, and I'm happy to run some of these winners to 20, 25 times, but I don't want to hold them to 50 times like you might have done in your former houses.
Right.
So the Damascene conversion has not been from either of us, but it's been a gentle recognition of our strengths and weaknesses. And I think my strength is value, balance sheets, and David's strength is very much on the GARP side. And I think he has moved very much from a growth, deep growth manager to what I'd call a growth at a reasonable price. And I think that is kind of what we were doing at, say, Martin Currie between 92 and 97 very successfully. And that's really what we're trying to recreate.
Okay. You know, we'll come on to that more, I'm sure. But can you take me a bit from, you know, leaving Polar, setting Zen or getting up in touch with David, you know, how did that happen basically?
Well, I was obviously bound by Pola's handcuffs, and I was sort of out of communication really for 18 months. I was able to set up the company. The CEO very kindly let me set up the company, Zenor, in 6 months after I set up, but I wasn't allowed to approach any clients till the following December. So I had a time out. I did another channel swim. Did lots of
swimming the English Channel. That
swimming the English Channel. Lots of different things. Spent a lot of time with my youngest kid, and generally took quite a relaxed approach to when I'd be able to compete. And we started off very, very small with Zenor. We started with just $10 million.
Yeah,
that actually was.
And did David come into it by chance, or what was there?
Honestly speaking, Jeremy. He was out of a job, and he was working for TT, and that had been bought by a Japanese company, by Sumitomo. And I think because of the double counting in terms of headcount, even though he was a real talent, he wasn't needed. So he was looking for something to do. I was looking for something to do. I think it's fair to say that I needed a bit of resuscitation of my career, and he did. So we both had one or two chips on our shoulders, and the two came together, and we said, look, we've made some mistakes, but we're happy to learn from those mistakes and come back a bit stronger.
And what was that like, kind of pitching to your early investors then? Were they a bit wary? Or
I'm sure
you got lots of good contacts.
Yeah, I think some of them were wary. But generally I think a year and a half out for a lot of managers is a really, really good thing. And I hadn't realized when I left Pola how exhausting it is after 20 years doing the same job. And I took, 6 months of doing absolutely nothing and just swimming and, spending time with my family. And actually, I think it is now a pretty crucial thing for a lot of fund managers to do, if they can afford to do that, is time-wise, is to have that period out. Because I think, I did a lot of reading and just stepped away from the whole industry. So it was very nice.
Yeah. And just, coming on to the fund's approach, I mean, we've discussed it already, really, talking about the importance of growth at a reasonable price and maybe kind of, marrying some of the principles of value and growth investing.
Yeah.
I mean, is it fair to say, in the portfolio today, the value element is winning a bit? I mean, looking at the kind of holdings you've got, top holding, is Bank of Kyoto. Yeah. And I think, your portfolio trades at quite a discount, trades at
a big discount
to its book value and a discount to the market. So it's a bit more on the value end. Is that right?
Yeah. I think if you go back to the early days of Martin Currie, Michael Thomas, my boss there, always used to have a sort of a motto, which was like, what we do if the market falls 10% is we go down about 7. And if the market goes up 10, we go up somewhere between 8 and 11. And over time, that wins a lot of plaudits and a lot of performance. And I think that's been very much my philosophy, which is to adapt a little bit to the GARP, but not to change anything too dramatically. For instance, if you looked at kind of style research, if you looked at a photo of where I was when I left, you probably find the value bars in style analytics would have been right at the top, and the growth bars would have been fairly pronounced downwards. And I think with David's introduction, the value side has continued to be pretty important, but a little bit less important. And the growth element is now kind of flat. We're not, we're not massively overweight growth. We're not massively underweight growth. We've got a small tilt on the downside to growth. But, David has had a pretty profound impact on a number of areas, particularly technology, which is an area that I don't feel that comfortable in. Technology, software, these are areas that he's very, very strong in. And of course, paying a lot of detail as a value manager to things like PEs and EV/EBITDAs in the tech space is not necessarily, and software not necessarily the right approach.
Okay. And, performance has been good since the launch in February 2021. The figures I've got here, this is in yen terms. Maybe we'll come on to the yen in a bit.
Yeah.
Up about 66% to the end of July versus, the sector, the Morningstar sector, up about 24.5%. So you've smashed your peers, basically. I mean, in a nutshell, what do you think has driven that strong performance?
I think about 80% of it has come from stock selection and probably 20% from asset allocation. We're not really allowed to talk about any benchmarks because we don't pay for those. But
okay.
I would say that stock picking has been very good, and we've probably had a less of a focus on the macro top-down view than historically I would have done in the last 5 years. We've very much focused on the bottom-up and paid less attention to macro drivers. So we just really focused on the individual companies. And I think that is kind of, again, probably what one was doing very well at Martin Currie and Schroders and Polar, certainly for the first 13 years. And then, you know, during Arbonomics, the macro side, you know, was so important that there was a danger for managers, and I talk in general, you know, got a little bit skewed by the three arrows and how important they were in determining stock selection. So, you know, if the yen weakens from 80 to 140, it has a very profound impact on earnings, obviously, fiscal policy and monetary policy. And I paid a lot less attention to that, a lot less attention to sort of global interest rates, to Japanese economic developments, and just focused on individual situations. And
yeah.
And particularly from a corporate governance perspective, a lot of the companies we own stand at very big discounts to book, have a lot of cash, a lot of unrealized gains on real estate, and there's a lot of activism taking place within those stocks.
Okay.
And that is, I think, has served us very well. But I give you one example of a company that David introduced to me, which was a tremendous performer, but it didn't really fall into my category, a company called Life Drink, which he introduced, a water bottler, a water and tea bottler. And it came to the market on a PE of about 10 times, and it derated, the shares fell about 20% to about 8 times. And it was trading already on about 3 times book because it's just beginning to build its equity. It's a relatively new company that was resuscitated by a private equity group. But we've made 3 times our money in that company, and it's now trading at still on 15 times earnings, but it's about 4 times book. But we've continued to hold it. It's continued to deliver very good earnings. It's raised its prices across its range of sparkling and still water offerings and tea offerings. And it's made a very good acquisition. It's expanding its capacity. And that's a good example where I've been able to fuse David's GARP, which probably historically I wouldn't have been so keen on, and said, look, you know, I'm happy to pay that price to book. Because the overall price to book for the fund, I think, is on 0.8 and the market is 1.2. So if we're paying for a 2% position or 3% position for 4 times book, it's not that exorbitant in the context of the average of the portfolio.
Okay. And basically, you're still feeling very optimistic about the portfolio today, or?
Yeah, I think the upside is somewhat less than it was 2.5 years ago.
Yeah.
But if you were to take the 50% of the market that trades below book and you were to push those back towards book value, the Nikkei would be at 42 to 44,000. I don't think that's going to happen overnight. But I think if you took a 3 to 4 year view, it's not impossible to see the previous highs of the Nikkei taken out. And that, technically, I think would be an incredibly bullish sign for the market if you were to take out the previous highs.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I suppose on that point, I mean, you know, Japan does face some well-known economic challenges, probably the most severe aging population in the world, and in other things which would kind of limit its domestic prospects. I suppose, you know, in light of some of those long-term concerns, where do you think we are in this shareholder return story that you've been talking about with improving corporate governance? I mean, is this a one-year opportunity, 3 years, or has it got much longer?
I think it'll run, you know, 3 to 5 years, five years, possibly a bit longer. Because what I'm finding, Jeremy, with Japanese companies, it's 2 steps forward, 1 step back. So for every couple of really good corporate governance reform stories you get one holding that you have or one that you look at that is actually digging its feet in the ground and saying that we're not prepared to change. So I think this will run for some time, but I think you have to look at the corporate restructuring story and this desire by the TSE to get companies above book and raise productivity very much in geopolitical terms about some of the structural changes that are taking place globally, deglobalization, decarbonization, less reliance on China, more reliance on places like Vietnam, on Japan, Japan's place within what I'd call the greater Asia co-prosperity sphere, you know, a friend towards the US and the West, whereas China is very much in that kind of as one of our economists refers to, the axis of evil along with Russia. And that's kind of interesting at the moment where you've got, you know, that axis of evil in recession, probably, given the Chinese property bubble, and you've got the rest of the West in very meager economic growth. So it's a very challenging time, I think, for Japan. So raising that productivity and having clear winners within the tech space, within the machinery space, within water purification, all the areas that Japan excels in, robotics, is very, very important. But to run those businesses as very high return on invested capital businesses that are conscious of their cost of capital.
Okay. And something else I wanted to touch on was, I think you've got some quite interesting consultants who feed you ideas, right? Is that you've got a few interesting contacts?
Yeah, we've built up a lot of contacts between both of us, and we hire four specific consultants who we pay each year. In no particular order, we hire three Japanese who are independent now. One is 82, wow. One is 65, and one is 60. The 82-year-old is into his 59th year in the Japanese market, and he promptly announced at the end of December he was having to cut back his working hours from 5 days a week to four. And
a historic step,
and his wife I think was a little bit perturbed about that because she likes to kick him out of the house. But he ferries around for us, and I think when you set up a boutique, you kind of do question whether when you're in your mid-50s or when you're getting into your mid-60s, and in his case, 80s, whether you're too old for this. And I do feel that there's been a very big change in the way that people above 45 in the industry are now being treated. I think if you had taken pre-GFC and how important the experience was, it was important, but generally having kind of young guns between 30 and 45 was very, very important for boutique organizations. I think post GFC and post COVID, that experience is really now vitally important. And if you look at our market as an example, 50% of our market has no analyst coverage. So in some cases, I mean, there's a copper miner we own. We did an interview with them a year ago. They wouldn't tell us what their unrealized gains on real estate were. And I had luckily shuffled through some notes from 1992 and found the unrealized gains that they'd told me in 1992, 31 years ago, was 25 billion yen, which is about $200 billion, to which I then said that's what the figure was from 1992. And he turned around and said, well, actually, it's about the same.
$200 million
of unrealized gains. And the market cap of the company is only about, at the time, was only about $400 million. So half of the market cap wasn't even accounted for in the balance sheet by those unrealized gains on equity, on real estate.
Gosh. Okay. So that shows the...
And a sense of history in Japan. I remember my former boss, Michael Thomas, saying that sense of history is really, really important, Jeremy, in Japan, because unlike the West, management doesn't change too much. And when it does change, it tends to be quite...
Gradual
and quite a seamless progression. Obviously, if you look at sort of operating margin cycles in America, they are relevant, but not nearly as relevant as they are in Japan.
Yeah. Last couple of questions, James. You've now launched the Zenor Japan Equity Income Fund. I suppose, why and what sort of prospective yield are you hoping to offer investors?
So it's a very different product. It is certainly a much higher value attribute product from us than the original fund. The original fund is this combination of David and I, Value and Garp. This is very focused on the reliability of past dividend streams and hopefully the reliability of future solid dividend growth. And the fund yield at the moment is about 3.2, which compares to just over 2 for the existing fund. And we plan to pay a biannual dividend. Mm-hmm. So I think it is fair to say that the process is somewhat different for the two funds. But if you were to say to look at the price earnings ratio of the original fund, it's about 14, whereas the price to earnings ratio of the new fund is 11.
Okay.
Price to book would be 0.6 versus the existing fund of about 0.8. So it is somewhat cheaper, and it is playing a really pure play on corporate governance, whereas I would say our existing fund gives you some of the corporate governance story. It gives you some GARP. It is not necessarily focused on, you know, one driver. But I think this is a clear play on corporate governance reform, capital allocation reform, which will enable companies to buy back shares to increase dividend coverage, increase dividend payout ratios. And it's a very interesting area. The fund is a lot smaller, so it can go a lot more micro cap at the moment as well.
Okay. I suppose last question, macro one. The yen's weakness has been really dramatic, much so I checked, and actually sterling investors in your fund would have received about half the return than if they were yen investors in Japan since launch. We'd said something. I suppose, you know, firstly, what do you make of that? And secondly, as an equity investor, I mean, do you care? Or
Obviously, we are very focused. We're very keen at Zenor not to launch a head share class. We find that we don't have a lot of demand for that, ironically. I think those who have invested in Japan ultimately share our view, which is the yen is a structurally massively undervalued currency at the moment. And it's driven wholly by, for me, carry trade, speculation, and the interest rate differential. But I think when that changes and when we see US interest rates beginning to peak out, which may be a little bit more time, but when we look at maybe an improving current account surplus in Japan and we look at PPP, which probably we suspect Japan should be trading at roughly 125, then I see every signs that we are in the exact inverse of where we were in 2012. And actually, at the time, my partner, Gerard Corley, and I were managing a segregated mandate. And we were hedged in that wrongly when the currency went from 100 down to 80. And, you know, I buckled at the last minute and we closed out that hedge at 80. And I feel it's almost the mirror image of that at the moment, where, you know, the currency's at 145. We know the Bank of Japan will probably intervene. We know that Japan may have more of an inflation problem than the markets actually make out. And, you know, gauging individuals' inflation expectations is very difficult for a central banker to come to that conclusion as to when the pendulum will swing. But I see every signs that wage inflation is more set in Japan. And obviously, as the currency depreciates further, imported inflation will continue to be a problem. And I think certainly the Bank of Japan's 2% target is going to prove to be way off this year, be closer to 3%. So watch this space. I don't know what the catalyst will be, but all I can say is when I was managing the Schroeder Japan Growth Fund in 98, a lot of my competitors were hedged. I think this was August 98, and the currency moved 20% in a day.
Wow.
And it can happen.
Yeah.
But obviously, who knows when.
Well, as you said, watch this space.
Watch this space.
That's all we've got time for, sadly, today.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you very much for coming in, and great to meet you again to speak more.
It's been great to speak. Thank you.
And last thing to say is thanks very much, everyone, for listening to the podcast. Please look out for more episodes soon.